This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have two members of the South Shore Roller Girls with us, a team that's based out of Portage, and they're holding an open call out on July 7th for anybody who's interested, and you don't have to be a skater either. We'll find out more about the Roller Girls and the team itself. Also, we have a conversation with Stephen Henshaw. He's the CEO of Enviro Forensics, based in Indianapolis, but they've just opened an office in Northwest Indiana in Hammond. We'll find out what the company is doing dealing with environment and pollution. Also, we have Tammy Silverman, the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, with us talking about the latest release of the national component of the annual Kids Count data book and how Indiana fared. That and more coming up, but first the news. This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The South Shore Roller Girls have been around for a while. In fact, they're celebrating a birthday coming up. We'll find out more about that in just a few minutes here. But Northwest Indiana has a roller derby league, and you may not be aware of that. So that's why we have two members of the South Shore Roller Girls with us here in the studio to talk about the team and about how long they've been around and what they've been doing. And the fact they have a call out later this week. In fact, July 8th, the South Shore Roller Girls will be putting out a derby call out. We have in the studio with us two members of the team. We have Lauren Reducen and we have Ellen Kaptan with us. Ladies, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having us.
Excited to be here.
Well, first, Lauren, I'll let you start since you're the spokesperson for the group here, and we'll bring Ellen into the conversation too. Tell us, how did the South Shore Roller Girls get started?
So we were part of another league back in 2012 to 2013, and they had disbanded. We had still had a majority of the girls that still wanted to skate, so we just kind of rallied together and put together what we have now, which is the now South Shore Roller Girls.
Now, how many girls are in the team right now?
Currently, I believe we have about 35 active members.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's enough to field two teams.
Uh-huh. So I guess the question comes down to, are there that many girls in Northwest Indiana that, A, can roller skate well enough to compete with other teams in the league, and all together that are basically very much involved in this and the camaraderie that you have that in creating such a league like this?
Yes. Everything, yes. we have a lot of girls on our league that have never even put on skates before they joined us, and mm-hmm. Yeah, once.
I take it Ellen must be one of them. Or have you been skating before, Ellen?
I've been skating now for 5 years, but I started as a, it was like my first time putting skates on, and I mm-hmm. put on also pads and a helmet, and I was ready to go. And people talk about not skating before, and I say, it sounds a little nerve-wracking to put on skates to probably fall down, but a lot of us started that way, and mm-hmm. We'll talk about that with our call out as well, as we give you the tools you need to be successful, and it's just a lot of heart.
Yeah.
How popular is roller derby here in Northwest Indiana, or for this part of the country, for that matter?
Oh, it's very popular. There mm-hmm. are teams from all over the world, actually. If you go to any state, there's almost a guarantee that there's going to be a roller derby team locally. Mm-hmm. So right now, just in the Northwest Indiana region, we kind of covered that area. We've just expanded a little bit. You know, we were in Michigan City for an event this last weekend, and a lot of people even out that way didn't know that there was roller derby out here. So it's slowly but surely getting bigger and bigger.
With the team being now 5 years old, what were the origins of it? If you got started, you got together 5 years ago and skated, or some of you didn't skate, what got you interested in creating a team of your own here?
Well, like I said, we were part of another league prior to this, and then we just didn't want to see it go. We just wanted to continue on and see what we could make of what we have now, and it was probably the best decision half of us have ever made.
What do you have in mind that when you created a roller derby team like this that got you together to begin with and kept you together all these years? Aside from being out there and fighting it out on the skates every single week or weekend.
One of the things that keeps me going are the friendships I've made. Mm-hmm. I've made some of the best friends you could ever imagine. The events that we host, the events that we go to, the fact that we give back to the community, it's just everything. It's not just the sport part of it. It's just everything that roller derby entails.
How many other teams are out there besides the South Shore Roller Girls?
Oh, gosh.
In the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, there's, I think, currently right around 400 teams, and that's worldwide.
Yeah.
But there's also teams that are not within that association, so
there's
I'm not sure.
There's men roller derby
men's
league.
Roller, junior teams.
There's junior teams, which there's even a junior league out here as well. There's different forms of roller, like different, I guess, not types of roller derby,
but different
rule sets of roller derby. I believe there's like three other rule sets as well. So, I mean, we're looking at probably closer to maybe like 800 different leagues around the world.
Now, how many teams do you get to compete with on a regular basis here in Northwest Indiana?
I think we have competed against probably closer to 25 other leagues.
Wow.
And the furthest I think that they've came from, I don't think have been further than 4 hours away.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you're talking like Southern Indiana, Southern Illinois. Our next team is actually Southern Illinois that's coming up to play with us. We've done Wisconsin, a ton of teams in Illinois, just everywhere.
Now, how about here in Indiana? Are there any other teams here, maybe not necessarily in Northwest Indiana, but within a four-hour drive of here?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Chicago has two teams. There's in Linwood, Illinois, there's a team. Aurora, South Bend, Fort Wayne, Indianapolis. I mean, just Lafayette, everywhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you would all have to have someplace to be able to practice.
Yes.
Where do you practice when you're all together as the South Shore Roller Girls?
Currently, we are practicing at the Gary Armory, which is just right in Gary. It fields our little location very nicely.
We've practiced at the Gene Shepherd Center in Hammond. We've practiced
Hammond Civic Center.
Yep.
NEO. It's the Adult Education Center in Portage. It used to be the old Camelot building, and it was turned into an adult education school. And they still have their sportsplex up, so they allowed us to skate there.
Now, I know that there are also regular locations that are set up for skating. Skate World's one of them in Portage.
Yes.
And I guess that's where you basically kind of work out of a lot, I understand. But what does it take to be able to set up a track, I guess it is, not only to practice, because you have to practice in what we consider real-world conditions. That is, you're going to have to practice someplace that are the type of conditions that you would actually have to compete in.
Mm-hmm.
What does it take to be able to set up a track that's banked and also that you get the experience and not only the experience but the actual workout that you need to do to be able to perform and compete?
Well, one thing that we have to clear, we are actually not on a bank track anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in the 70s when roller derby kind of, I guess, fell out. Roller derby was founded in the 30s, I believe.
Well, I understand. Yeah, that's the question to bring in. So you go back, when you talk about going back into the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
when the idea came about.
Yes. So we're on a flat track now.
Which really makes our life a lot easier. Yes, we don't have to find a place for the track to be all the time.
Yeah.
I think it's a little... never been on a bank track. I'm a little too scared to use it, but I'm thankful that we don't have to set it up.
Yes.
I think the first thing that we look for our track is, well, flat ground. We can play play on anywhere from polished concrete to wooden floors, like you'll find at most skate rinks. We've
sport
practiced.
Court.
Yep, sport court's another good one. And we have very specific measurements for our track that we have to find. So before every practice, we are out measuring the track, laying it down, helping each other out. It takes,
I would say, about 10 minutes during just a practice to set up our track.
Right.
But then for game day, I think we need at least a minimum of an hour to 2 hours to set up a track, because we have to measure it out, you know, for the requirements, then we have to tape it down and put rope down and tape it down some more and, you know, measure every 10 feet. There's a lot more work to go into like an actual game day track than there is for like a practice track.
We're talking with Lauren Reducen and Ellen Capitan. They're members of the South Shore Roller Girls, which is a Portage-based team of young women that are involved in roller skating. And, of course, the history of roller skating is going back many, many years. But in particular, the idea of a roller derby goes back at least, I would think, you said the 1930s, probably we know it mainly from the idea that the roller teams ended up on television as some of the very first television shows, when people had black and white TVs and they had a chance to actually buy them or watch at somebody's house. Roller Derby was one of the first shows that were on. I know that I'm sure that's probably where the history goes back into particular. Did you know of any teams that made it on television here in the Chicago area?
I don't think I have really looked back that far, fortunately. I do have a fun fact, though. At the Hammond Civic Center is where roller derby used to play back in the day in this area.
Right.
And the last game was, I believe, in 1973, if I'm not mistaken. And our team was the first one to bring it back to the Hammond Civic Center back at the end of 2015.
Maybe I should ask the question. I wouldn't hate to embarrass anybody, but did any of your mothers roller skate and get involved in teams? Or did you have friends or family members or relatives that maybe were involved in roller derby teams?
Not that they've told us.
Right, yeah.
But they would admit to, right? I suppose they would be too embarrassed. But somebody had to know about this ahead of time, and you had to know about this or learn this from other people to be able to keep even in the last 5 years since the Roller Girls have been in existence, to keep the idea of roller derby alive.
Yes.
Well, I would say an interesting thing happening right now with roller derby is that it's becoming even more mainstream than it had been. Mm-hmm. With the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, there's a lot of rules and protocol to follow and a lot of steps to get through to be recognized as that. So when we think back to the roller derby that was on TV, if you did a side-by-side comparison, it would almost feel like unrecognizable. I see pictures where people aren't wearing helmets, and I get a little...
It was almost like combat.
Yeah, I worry about them.
Really dangerous.
You know, throwing elbows, clotheslining people.
That's what people ask me if I'm clotheslining, and I said I could, but then I get a penalty and I have to sit out.
So it's basically like full body checks now, legally.
One of the things that we wanted to mention about not only the team itself, but the fact that they have an open call out coming up on July 8th. And Lauren, tell us about who all you're interested in bringing in at the call out in Portage this weekend.
We are interested in everyone coming out as long as you're over the age of 18. Mm-hmm. You do not have to have any prior experience with skating. You don't have to have any prior knowledge of roller derby. We will literally teach you everything. Now, when it comes to the actual sport part of it, we are asking women only. But if you want to become a referee, a non-skating official, men and women are more than welcome to come out.
By the way, the call-out is coming out here on July 8th. It's going to be at Skate World, which is at 3600 Scottsdale Street in Portage. And you can learn about what World of Derby is all about. And you mentioned that there are people, I guess, involved in this, referees and all, people mm-hmm. that don't have to skate. But I suppose that if you want to be a referee, that you have to have some knowledge of roller skating, number one.
Yes.
And number two, you have to know a little bit about what World of Derby is all about.
Right. Well, that's another thing is that we teach you everything.
Right.
So when it comes to reffing, you do have to go through pretty much the same program to learn everything. You have to do the same skills that we have to know. I think a little bit more with like stopping, I guess, in case if a girl gets thrown into you, you have to know how to stop that. We literally will teach you everything from skating to, you know, what penalties are what, you know, different hand signals when it comes to the actual gameplay of it, you know, just literally everything we will teach you.
Now, we talked about the open call out, which is coming up on July 8th in Portage. We mentioned the fact that the South Shore Roller Girls are a team, members of a team that are now in the fifth year. Your fifth birthday is coming up here.
That's super exciting.
It was obviously you're going to have something important to show to everybody that shows up for the fifth birthday. It's more than a celebration of itself. There's actually going to be competition that day, and I guess a doubleheader, I understand.
Yes, the doubleheader. We will be having the Lake Effects Junior Roller Derby team, which is another local team. It's for children ages, I believe, 9 to 17 that want to get involved in roller derby. They're going to be having a mixer, so it's basically just kind of junior leagues from all over the state as well. They will be opening up for us. This will be the first time that they've actually been like having a game in Northwest Indiana, so that's super exciting. And then we will be showcasing our skills and everything at about 7:30. Our game will be starting, and we will be competing against the Southern Illinois Roller Girls.
Now, we should mention that the fifth birthday bout and the doubleheader are going to happen on Saturday, July 14th, and it's going to happen not in Portage, but at the old ground, so to speak,
yes,
the Hammond Civic Center.
Hammond. So. And there's not a bad seat in that place. It's all amazing seating.
Well, that's why I would think that you would want to have a chance if you're going to go out there and give it your all, not only for your team members, but for everybody that shows up. You want to have everybody have a chance to be able to see everything.
It's
even better than going to a baseball game,
yes,
I would imagine.
Absolutely.
For folks that are not familiar necessarily with the Hammond Civic Center, tell us first where it is and how people can get in, and tell us a little bit about the place itself, because it has that history of roller derby in it.
Sure. So the Hammond Civic Center is headed north on Calumet past 94. It's always a little further than I think it's going to be.
Yeah.
I adore the Hammond Civic Center. The wood floor in there is very reminiscent of old school derby. And Lauren talked about the seating. They have like a stadium style seating, so you can sit up in the second tier bleachers and get a bird's eye view of the whole competition. I really enjoy being there because I feel like the Civic Center has all these secrets. There's the downstairs locker rooms. There's different staircases. I always enjoy hanging out at the Civic Center. But again, to what Lauren was saying, perfect place to watch, perfect place to see everyone at the same time.
Yes.
Now, I have to ask the question, and try to do this as delicately as I can. Roller derby is known, I guess, for mature women who've been out there, but your young ladies that have gotten involved, how many members of the team now are we'll say, under the age of 30?
Well, I still am currently.
I think the really spectacular thing about roller derby is that we really bring in all types.
Yeah.
And when we do these call-outs and when these girls graduate into the programs, it's so fun learning a little more about them. I mean, we have people from all walks of life. They may be the under 30 crowd. They may be mothers. They may be grandmothers. We have engineers, hairdressers, teachers. We have a ton of different people with stories and backgrounds, and we all come together for one single cause, which is so fun. And I think it really builds us not just as a team, but like Lauren talked to earlier, friendships that you would have never really thought.
It's almost like an extended family, isn't it?
It really is.
Oh, sure is.
Absolutely. So. We've been invited to birthday parties, baptisms. I mean, even graduation parties with everyone.
Well, and you mentioned, too, and this was happening with the call-out coming out on July 8th, the fact that it's for skaters and for non-skaters. So, obviously, there's some people that may be a little bit leery of learning how to skate, and certainly to be able to do something like this. But they have something that they can do to help the team along, sounds like.
That's true. And as we're a team that's league-run, so we don't just show up and skate every day. We have different committees that help fuel us forward. So, Lauren's with our PR, marketing, we have events, we have personal training, we have our merchandisers. So we all have our own strengths that we bring to keep the league running. So we're
for the skaters,
by skaters.
Once again, the South Shore Roller Girls Derby call-out is going to be on this coming weekend, July 8th, as a matter of fact. It's going to be at the Skate World, which is, again, at 3600 Scottsdale Street in Portage. Begins at 11 o'clock in the morning, and that's where anybody can come out and learn more about the team, about the roller skate derby action. And then the big event is coming up for the fifth birthday bout, we should say, and the doubleheader is going to happen on Saturday, July 14th, and it's going to be at the Hammond Civic Center, which is at 5825 South Soul Avenue in Hammond, just north of 8094. And if you know where the Hammond Civic Center is, if you've been to the Civic Center, you know what the building may be like, but have you ever been there during a roller derby? Mm-hmm. Well, here's your chance to find out by attending and cheering the team along here on Saturday, July 14th. We've had in the studio to talk about the South Shore Roller Girls, Lauren Reducen, and to her teammate and friend, Ellen Capitan. And ladies, thank you for spending time with us to talk about not only the team, about the interest of the Northwest Indiana has historically had, apparently, in roller derby, but what the team is going to be doing here in the weeks and months ahead. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Well, we're glad that you came by. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. An Indianapolis-based company which deals with environmental consulting and engineering and the like is opening up a Northwest Indiana office. The company is called EnviroForensics, and we have the CEO of EnviroForensics with us, Steve Henshaw. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit about the company and what you do and how expansive the company is, because you're not in just Indiana, but several other states too.
Right, yes. EnviroForensics has been was established in 1996, so we're about 23, 24 years old. And we do environmental cleanups, investigations of contaminated sites, but our unique niche is finding the funding to pay for these very expensive cleanups.
Mm-hmm.
So our approach is to look and see if we can find some resources through old insurance policies, normal slip-and-fall type insurance policies that didn't have exclusions to those policies for contamination, for environmental pollution. So that's what really makes us special, is we have a group of insurance archaeologists. They go through records, court proceedings. We've been to the Pentagon. We've looked in all sorts of places for evidence of insurance going back to the 50s, 60s. So when you're looking at industrial properties that have been around for the better part of half a century, we try to look at the full spectrum of what might be available as far as bringing resources to pay for these cleanups. That's what makes us a little different than, say, a normal environmental engineering and cleanup mm-hmm. company.
Do you find that by going back in history, so to speak, here and back in the records, that you're able to go back and help get some of these problem areas cleared up because you've been able to find some loopholes, so to speak, in insurance policies that'll let you do it?
Yeah, absolutely. We're very very effective at this. We've cleaned up several hundred sites using historical insurance, and probably at any one time we have about 120 projects going on where the funding source is primarily old insurance policies, primarily, mm-hmm. if not 100%. So that's something that a lot of people don't realize is how valuable these just normal old slip-and-fall CGL policies can be. We've also used those to, even effectuate cleanups on properties that have gone bankrupt, where the owners have gone bankrupt, or perhaps the owners have passed on. So we go back in time, and that's what we try to do is go back and do the history of operations and see how we might be able to bring some resources to not only the property owner, but oftentimes to the community. So a lot of these sites might be distressed, sitting there, on the tax, on the tax roll, but not in any kind of active productive use. So mm-hmm. they aren't really benefiting the community. And we can also assist municipalities at pursuing the same sort of options of finding these resources to pay for these very expensive long-tail liabilities.
I noticed that you've, in your information that we're looking at here, is that it mentions that there have been dozens of projects in Northwest Indiana that EnviroForensics has been involved in, including work for the city of Gary, among other places. Unfortunately, Gary and East Chicago are probably two prime cities where there are a lot of problems like this lying in wait to be resolved.
Well, that's true. Being old industrial cities, all along the lake shore like that, this is a tool that we would like to bring to maybe a higher level, a higher focus. We've certainly done work on behalf of the airport, the sanitary district, the dredging project that was in the waterway there in East Chicago. We've done some large program management work, but we've also done a lot of smaller dry cleaners and small mom-and-pop operations. We've been in situations even where banks have had notes that they did not want to foreclose on for obvious reasons. They were contaminated, and they didn't want to stand in those shoes. And so we've been involved with the acquisition of bad bank notes and chattel paper to then go back and clean these properties up as well. So we've done that in Crown Point, and been involved with a number of small businesses throughout the region.
We're talking with Stephen Henshaw, who is the CEO of a company called EnviroForensics. Based out of Indianapolis, they work in several states, including Indiana and surrounding states like Wisconsin and Kentucky. Then now they're going to open up an actual Northwest Indiana office in Hammond. Do you think that by having a all this work that you've done in Northwest Indiana so far, of course, you've had to have representatives come up from Indianapolis, I'm sure, to be able to do the work on these occasions, that the working out of Hammond will be a lot easier and maybe bring in more business?
Well, yes. You know, for a long time, we've been very supportive of the communities. And a lot of that was, of course, driving up and down I-65. So we have now an actual resident that has been with us along several years that wants to be in the region, and you know it's a great opportunity for us because oftentimes we find that just moving someone up there, it doesn't really create the provincial understanding of communities, and certainly we want to be a part of the Northwest Indiana, and recognize its history and heritage. So by having a local be heading up that branch in Michelle Merday, we're very excited that this gives us a stronger foothold in the community itself. So we're not just popping up an office. We've done a lot of work there, of course, for years and years. But we're not just popping an office up there just for the purpose of gaining more, access to the community. We're also wanting to be a part of the community. And so we do a lot of work assessing environmental problems for communities as sort of a pro bono effort as well, because we recognize the limitations that the communities have on their budgets. So, we want to be involved and actually be a technical resource for the community.
Let's take a moment, if you will, Steve, and kind of talk about what work is involved in opening up a branch office like the one here in Northwest Indiana that's opened up on Holman Avenue in Hammond. What type of work, besides all of the really difficult things of finding office space, and you have a very good place to be able to set up this operation too, I understand.
Mm-hmm. We do. Yeah. We looked at a number of office locations and felt that being involved in the city center of Hammond was a great place for us to sort of put down our roots, so that we can help establish a growing demand for the office space and revitalization of the downtown area. Of course, there's like in any situation where you're opening a new office, you've got all the administrative issues, but more importantly, it's establishing your network of relationships. And because we've done work in East Chicago, in Gary, in Hammond, and in the other communities as well, we will actually be making quite an effort to integrate into the business community, and that's going to be our number one goal and focus is to, how do we integrate into the various associations, the Northwest Indiana Forum, the regional business associations and alliances, mm-hmm. and to become better known. So that'll be our biggest challenge is developing those relationships.
Well, Stephen, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the business and about what you've done and the reason why you want to expand with your own office in Northwest Indiana to continue on helping the communities here. We've been talking with Stephen Henshaw, who's the CEO of a company called EnviroForensics, based out of Indianapolis, but are opening up a Northwest Indiana office in Hammond. And thank you for talking with us about it.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, the latest information is out, taking a look at the rankings across the country, and Hoosier children continue to be ranked in sort of the middle of the pack, so to speak, when it comes to their overall well-being. The 2018 Kids Count Data Book is out from the National Report, and to find out all about it, let's check in with the Indiana Youth Institute's president and CEO, Tammy Silverman. Tammy, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
It's always my pleasure, Chris. Glad to be here.
One of the things we should mention right at the bat is that this is information looking at a report that was put together from all of the states in the country, not just from Indiana. Actually,
correct.
We've had the Indiana data out already, haven't we?
You're right. So Indiana, we produce ours in February, and then between February and June, they roll up all the states, and then they compare how we're doing compared to the nation and how we're doing compared. We particularly like to look at how we're doing compared to our neighboring states.
Right. Well, let's take a look at that. Let's see how does Indiana rank with the other 49 states in the well-being of young people.
Well, we are ranked 28th in the nation for child well-being, which is exactly the rating that we were at last year. So we're behind Illinois and Ohio, but we're ahead of Michigan and Kentucky.
Now, looking at the data, how do they put it together as far as the other states are concerned? You kind of mentioned in our last conversation about the Indiana data, but how does everything kind of fit in together nationwide?
Sure. Well, they break it down into really just four big categories, which is economic well-being, education, health, and then family and community. And they collect certain markers within each of those categories, so then we can compare them across the country. So, you know, all of that breakdown is available on our website. If somebody really wants to dig deep into the data, it's all out there and it's searchable online at IYI.org. So it's really those four big categories.
Let's talk about some of the information here that you've been able to rank here. And we've talked before about the concerns about low birth weight babies and about the sadness of child and teen deaths. How does Indiana rank based on the national report?
Well, you know what? We're fairly consistent with some of them. Overall, we're still, for infant mortality, we're still ranked 41st in the country, which is not where we want to be, obviously. But as far as children who lack health insurance, the child and teen death rate, the number of teens that use or abuse alcohol or drugs, we're fairly consistent with the national average on each of those.
Now, as far as we mentioned before about the problems involving the opioid crisis, and we talked before on how the statewide kids count data book showed up, how does the state of Indiana show up compared to the other nations?
You know, as far as those particular health indicators, we rank 31st overall for health. And so, again, that's a little lower than our overall well-being, and we can talk about, you know, we have our bright spots, actually education. So in health, we're 31st, and that's the lowest amongst any of the neighboring states in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Once again, I guess we talk about the importance of knowing how to take care of ourselves, particularly our children, and we talk about all the problems that young people can have. We've talked before about the impact that the opioid epidemic has on young people, not only from their health standpoint too, but their psychological standpoint because of the impact that being in a family, sadly, they may have a number of people that are addicted. It's going to mean their young people are not going to be as well taken care of as they should be.
You're absolutely right, Chris. And we talk about that kind of in the terms of toxic stress. And there's an awful lot of that on our kids these days. So if a child is growing up in a home where there's acute substance abuse, that is going to just create a really stressful environment that can impact their physical well-being as well as their brain development. So it's really important to start screening for that, right? And to say, if we know that that's the case for kids, what are we doing to effectively intervene and build what they call some of those protective or resiliency factors so that we can make sure that they grow up to be healthy and successful?
One of the things we've talked about in the past and that we went trying to build together, although it's not specifically in the National Kids Count data book, is the problems that Hoosier young people have about obesity. And this being the summer months, you wouldn't necessarily connect the two together, but young people can become chubby and out of weight, not of the weight specter, we should say, properly, about any time of the year, so it doesn't really matter. So we talk about it this time of year, and I know because this is the summer vacation months.
Well, you're right, and I think sometimes you think summer kids are out running around, you know, they're maybe going to a park or a pool, or they're being very active, but part of the challenge is they may also not have access to the healthy food they need, which they typically might get during the school day as part of a school lunch program. So actually, you know, food insecurity, if you're food insecure, you're also more likely for our child to be overweight, because what that often means, it's not that you don't have any food sometimes, it's that the food you have access to is not healthy and it's more likely to contribute to being overweight or obese.
Well, what does the IYI recommend that parents and caregivers do to try to make sure that young people during the summer months, in between the times that they normally would get those school lunches and breakfasts, if they're so qualified to get those, what should they do to help try and keep their weight under control?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, the Department of Education does, there are food summer food programs all over the state, and each of those locations are on their website. So I would suggest going to the Department of Ed and finding where those healthy foods, where you can access those even during the summer. The other thing is a little more practical. It's a little more down on, just at your home level. And they say that even adding 30 minutes of additional activity a week can make a big difference in little kids' lives as far as their activities. And it doesn't have to be a big robot. You know, we're not talking about doing marathons or doing triathlons or even complex summer camps. It can be as easy as taking a walk around the block or shooting some hoops or going for a short bike ride. It's really just about getting up and getting out of the house and putting down all those screens and get moving a little bit more.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And we mentioned before we started our conversation here that this is kind of wrapping up the fiscal year for you folks there at the IYI, based in Indianapolis. And you probably get a chance now to take a look at how well some of the programs and the projects went for 2017 and 2018. How do things shape up?
You bet. And it's been really a great year. What we're seeing is throughout the state of Indiana, in all the regions, is that we're at a place where we really are paying a lot of attention to what do our kids need, again, to thrive and be successful. One of the things that we say is that, right now, Indiana's child population is 25% of our current population in the state. However, we know that it's 100% of our future, right? And so it's been a great year of a lot of collaborations, a lot of groups coming together to say, there's a lot of great stuff going on, right? And so maybe two or three organizations can come together to create even a larger impact. So clearly from this report, we still have a long way to go. Being ranked 28th, I think, clearly mm-hmm. there's room for improvement. But we're seeing a lot of in-depth collaborations, a lot of these complex challenges that are out there, such as childhood obesity. People are coming together so that we can take those on head on as collective communities and regions.
Do we find that because of the data that comes in, not only compared to our other states in the Midwest, but the rest of the country, that, that you folks at the IYI can kind of sit and look, well, this is what this particular state is doing or that particular state's doing. We can do this same sort of thing, but we can do it better. Do you have a chance to do some comparing and contrasting here?
You're right. So this is the data's hot off the presses, but you're absolutely right, Chris. That's the next step is for us to take a look at. So as we said before, if one of our neighboring states, Illinois or Ohio, are ranked a little better than we are in a category, let's reach out and have a conversation with them. There's no need to reinvent the wheel, right? Let's talk to them about what's been working for them, have a few of those conversations, and then see what we can bring home here to Indiana that can help our kids. Okay.
Tammy Silverman, President and CEO of the IYI, thank you for being with us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
The national data is in from other states around the Midwest and the country here, and it's compiled in the latest of the series of Kids Count data books, this one coming out for 2018. Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman was with us on Regionally Speaking recently to talk about a new topic before her and others, the creation of what she called a trauma center in Gary, and it isn't part of any medical group.
We have an initiative for people who have been affected by trauma. Mm-hmm. And if you think about this area, the enormous amount of environmental contamination, the drug wars, the mass incarceration, police killings, poverty, unemployment, this is not just a problem for our society and for people, it causes trauma. A lot of people don't think of trauma in that way, but many, many things can cause trauma. And what trauma does is it actually shuts down your rational brain and relies on what's called your reptilian brain, the little piece of instinct at the back of your head. And so people who are controlled by that brain do impulsive things to protect themselves. They protect themselves from dangers that are not there, which ends up in isolation, depression, and all kinds of problems. And obviously, it's not just a psychological problem, it's a physical problem. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful book called The Body Holds the Score by Van der Kolk, who is the leading psychiatrist in the field of new forms of treating trauma. And we are going to open one right in Gary and in Northwest Indiana. So we have a group of people who have set up something called the Hope Center. HOPE stands for Haven of Peace and Empowerment. And such a place exists in the Black community in Boston called Roxbury. So we flew three people in here to talk about it. And they did an evening presentation, a morning presentation about how to do community-based, community and trauma-informed healing. And we had over 80 people come.
Wow.
Actually, maybe even closer to 90 people come. And they came because they know what a problem trauma is and how much it hurts people and makes them feel like there's something wrong with them, but they have nowhere to turn. They certainly can't turn to a $150 psychiatrist because a lot of these people have no health care. So what we did is these folks came, including the woman whose son was murdered and after which their center is named, the Corey Johnson Center. And she talked about how this helped her after the murder of her son and how they train community people to be companions, to help people. And they do programs that are collective, not individual, and that involve not only the mind and the body, but the spirit and the soul. So they have breathing, they have music, they have art, and they have a program, which is what we'll start with, called Can We Talk? People come, they serve a free dinner, then they have a saxophone player from, I mean, he is fabulous. I heard it on the video. Mm-hmm. And then people can stand up and share stories if they want. And what happens after one or two people do it, and we had a simulation in both our meetings, is other people stand up and share something that's been very painful for them. And the impact of this, of recognizing that you're not alone, that there are other people to help you who have gone through similar things, is very powerful. So we had over, I think, 45 people say, we want to be trained so that whatever it is we do can be trauma-informed. And we will have childcare workers, we will have kitchen workers, we will have janitorial workers, and community companions, and we will pay them. A minimum, this was my argument, I won, $15 an hour minimum wage. But also, this training will be at the end of August. And we are very excited. The first place where we will have Can We Talk will be at Reverend John Jackson's church, Trinity United Church of Christ, on Lincoln and 20th Avenue. Mm-hmm. And we will also then be recruiting people who want to work. If you want to, if you want to do childcare, you will get paid and you will be trained. And we will, we set up a budget. We laid out a year plan. And it looks like the folks in Boston will be coming back here August 25th, free of charge to us because they got a grant to spread their program. And so they will do a two-day training on the 25th and 26th. Again, we will feed people and we will take care of you. And if you come, you will be able to be a community partner, a child-informed childcare worker, whatever you do for this program, you will get paid. Because if there's one thing that people in this area need, is paid employment and not at $7.25 an hour.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about looking to getting some assistance to keep the program going, are there any plans, or at least I'm sure there's been some discussion so far in the work about for the Hope Center to get some grants to find the foundations or other organizations to help keep it going?
We had an anonymous donation that will keep us going for at least a year.
Mm-hmm.
But we also are looking to partner with HealthNet. Not to get money from them, because they are rich in people, poor in money. But they will refer people to us. They will give us help on finding employees. And we're going to explore the Boston, for example, program gets money from the main hospitals in Boston. And it's a very competitive atmosphere here. We want support from hospitals, but this is a different kind of program than what they do. We don't want someone saying, I'll help you if I can take it over.
Yeah.
This will always be grassroots, community-based collective healing. And whether you are a survivor of the Iraq or Vietnam War, whether you were raped as a child, any of these things, we will provide a support network that will help you move through the pain and be able to have better relationships with people, feel better about yourself, stop blaming yourself for the problems you experience. And you know, in schools, when children are hyperactive, they give them medication. Very often that hyperactivity is the result of trauma. And they never look into it, and all they do is medicate. Personally, I've been on medication for over 20 years, and I've talked my heart out because I'm a trauma survivor. And somebody once asked me, well, did it help? I said, I really understand my trauma, but no, it did not help. But I can see how this makes a difference because it connects you to community. And often that's what's missing in survivors' lives.
Do you think that in addition to not only bringing the community together to talk about the problems and helping people deal with the traumas that they face, this may have a side benefit in dealing with such things as the opioid crisis, because that's a dependence because of trauma?
Absolutely.
Or even worse still, about the suicide rate that happens in Northwest Indiana?
Absolutely. Because all of this is usually rooted in distant traumas that people met. I didn't remember some of the traumas in my life, particularly the main trauma, until I was in my 50s. And then it hit me. I had a breakdown, and I had no idea how this could be. But this will help many things. Plus, people who are traumatized feel helpless and hopeless. And this city needs activists. And that's how I came to this. Mm-hmm. Because you can't get people active if they are suffering. You have to give them a hand, help them gain confidence, self-love, self-esteem. And then they can stand up and say, whoa, no more dumps in Gary. Hey, stop those deportations.
This is Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman. Time now for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Jenny Bennett Bishinsky, who is an event coordinator with Valparaiso Events. And Valparaiso Events, is that part of the city government, Jenny?
Actually, it is not. We are our own organization. We're our own entity. Valparaiso Events is actually a nonprofit in the city of Valpo.
Okay.
And we certainly work closely with the Parks Department and the Chamber of Commerce and the city of Valpo and all those great organizations that we're blessed enough to have in our town. But we're actually a nonprofit that does events on our own. And most of them are free. We have about 100 days throughout our event season of different event days, and only, gosh, I think 4 of those are ticketed, and the rest of them are for free, things that we do right here downtown for the community. So, yep, we're separate.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but what is the event that you're best known for?
You know what? The one we're probably best known for is Popcorn Festival.
Yes.
And actually, this year is our 40th, believe it or not.
Wow.
The first one was way back in 1979. And now we're known for the artists and crafters and music and food that we have that day.
Mm-hmm.
Usually between about 60 and 70,000 people descend on our little town. And this year, it's going to be held on September 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And Soul Asylum is actually the headlining band that day.
Wow.
So it's going to be very exciting to celebrate the 40th anniversary. Yeah, we're excited.
That's fantastic. Well, mm-hmm. congratulations on that. So you are incorporating the arts as a way to celebrate and create events for people in Valpo and
sure.
outside of Valpo, certainly, to come and enjoy. What and just recently you've been the pop-up. I can't remember the exact name of it.
Yeah, so the pop-up is something that we're actually working on right now. Popcorn Fest isn't until September, but in June and July, we're going to be focusing on our Valparaiso Market, which has music and artists, and then also the pop-up. And so the pop-up is an event where 20 different venues in downtown Valparaiso are going to display different pieces of artwork from local artists in Northwest Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about it is that it's a contest. So a little bit different than some other art displays that go on during the summer. This particular event is going to have brochures and maps available to the public, and then the public can physically go to the 20 different venues and vote for their favorite art displays, or they can go online and vote online. And so all of that begins on June 21st.
Mm-hmm.
It ends July 6th. The maps and brochures will be available throughout the month of June and the first week of July at our Valparaiso Farmers Market and Urschel Pavilion and at our Valparaiso Events Office. So all the way through that first week of July, people can find the maps and brochures.
That's great. And then you have a big culminating event. Is this in conjunction with the Shakespeare in the Park?
It is. We really enjoy working with Eric and Chicago Street Theater, and their event, Shakespeare in the Park, is Friday, July 6th and Saturday, July 7th. And so we are going to have our grand finale awards presentation for the pop-up on Saturday, July 7th under the Urschel Pavilion,
mm-hmm.
and we will be awarding the artists that night and presenting checks and announcing the winners of the pop-up, and then that will be followed by the second evening of Shakespeare in the Park. So we're super excited to work with Eric and his team. They're fantastic.
Yeah. Well, Valpo is just a cultural hub, isn't it?
Well, we try, yes.
No,
and really good partnerships. We really all work well together.
Is this just the second year for the pop-up?
Actually, it's our third.
Okay.
Little bit different take on it this year. We have a bigger pool of artists and a wider variety of pieces, for sure.
Okay.
It's close to 200 pieces that will be on display for that 2 weeks.
Okay.
And voting will end on Friday, July 6th. And so it's kind of nice because, you know, people, that's a holiday week. And so people hopefully will have time to kind of leisurely walk around downtown mm-hmm. Valpo and explore the venues and the art. So we're excited about how the timeline's going to fall this year.
Well, that's great. Well, I congratulate you on all of this activity. And it sounds like you're doing a great job. Your organization's doing a great job.
Thank you.
Celebrating the arts and celebrating Valparaiso. That's great.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Jenny, for being with
Thanks
us.
Thanks so much for having us. We appreciate it.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Be back with you tomorrow.